Welcome to the Moral Psychology Seminar Series. We're delighted today to welcome David Pizarro from Cornell and Guy Kahane from Oxford University. And I think we have David first on a talk entitled The Mismeasure of Morals.
Thank you very much. It is really a deep pleasure to be here. Thank you to all of those who had anything to do with me being here. And for those who don't, you will be equally grateful after this. really, this is a wonderful opportunity to meet and talk to people about something that has been on my mind for quite some time, which is something I take it that you're already familiar with if you're here, the study of human morality. In the last, 10 or so years, the interest in the study of human morality has obviously exploded. And in fact, one of the reasons that I think it became so popular is because there were developed a few critical methods that seemed like a very easy way to assess human morality. And so it used to be that you had to do really sloppy things like Kohlberg and actually interview and talk to people about their beliefs. This would take hours of coding, and as psychologists, you would think that we like to interact with people, but really we just like to not interact with people and actually talk to them about their morals. So with the explosion of research on morality, the explosion of research using a particular set of methods has co-occurred. And one of those methods is what we're talking about today, which is the use of what we might call trolley problems, but specifically the use of sacrificial moral dilemmas that were constructed by a set of philosophers, really to try to distinguish normative questions, so normative theories, to try to tease apart people's, at least normative claims about what ought to be the theory that we endorse. Sort of as moral philosophers or as anybody interested in normative ethics and the question of what we ought to do. So it didn't take long before psychologists realized that these little packets, right, these little dilemmas, sacrificial moral dilemmas that pit two of the big, the most dominant normative ethical theories against each other, provided a very, very nice way of assessing lay judgments about normative ethics. That is, we could ask the question, just like philosophers do, but with a different task. We can say, not just ought we be consequentialists or deontologists, but what are people, right? And this has been the driving force, I think, of a lot of research generated in the last 10 years, answering the question of, if we look at your average person, the unschooled person, the person who hasn't been debauched by the philosophical literature, and we give them these scenarios, this is a great way of poking and prodding the moral mind and seeing what comes out. And that has been the promise. Now, I want to just quickly say, Simona and I were talking last night about this, there are plenty of people who are using methods that are not sacrificial moral dilemmas, not trolley problems. In fact, it is a bit unfair to criticize moral psychology solely on the basis of this particular method. But it is a method that seems to promise something that I'm not quite sure it has delivered on, and I think there are reasons why it hasn't delivered on. And while this was framed as a debate, I think that Guy and I are probably largely in agreement about the problems. So I want to talk a little bit about the problems as I see them, as somebody who ironically has relied on some of these manipulations, some of these measures. So I don't know, perhaps I should just quickly explain what we mean by trolley problems. I don't know if anybody here in this audience won't have heard these. But here by sacrificial moral dilemmas, we mean that class of scenarios that have been constructed with usually a dichotomous choice at the end where you pit two actions against each other, two potential courses of action. One, the famous one being the trolley scenario where people are asked if it is morally permissible. The language is actually meaningful, and I don't know if you'll talk about this, but if you ask people, for instance, is it morally permissible to pull a lever to divert a train that would be killing 5 people that were stuck on the track, to divert the train in order to only kill 1 person, you say, is this morally permissible? The traditional formulation of the trolley problem, as we call it, is as follows. When you tell people, when you ask people, is it morally permissible to pull a lever in order to, a train that would normally kill 5 people will now kill 1, most people say, well, yeah, you know. I mean, some people say, well, I don't want to do it. But if you ask, is it right, is it okay, is it morally permissible, people say, yeah. So whatever estimates we have, the majority of people seem to say, yes, it's okay. When you contrast that with a different version of the scenario in which you are killing 1 to sacrifice 5, this time it's instead of pulling a lever, you have to push a very large individual onto the tracks to their death in order to stop a trolley from killing 5 people. Suspension of disbelief is always required in these, and this may be a problem that we can talk about later. People have very, very different intuitions. And so the trolley problem really properly is the juxtaposition of those two examples. What is the difference between pulling a lever, causing somebody to die in order to save more people, and pushing somebody to their death, again, causing someone to die? And you'll note that it's not that it's one is inaction. It's not act versus omission. It is actually both cases, their action. So this was a useful way to tease apart on the one hand, it provides a nice description of why people might have non-consequentialist intuitions, that it's really wrong to push someone to their death, but it provides this also additional puzzle as to what is the distinction that people are making that makes their intuition seem to be so strong in the case of impermissibility in the fat man version, and permissibility in the pull the switch version. So you can see that there's an interesting psychological question there. You could provide normative reasons, as philosophers have, but an interesting question is, well, what are the psychological mechanisms that are causing this distinction to occur? And perhaps that is where, although Josh Green was not the first to use these sorts of scenarios, this is the question that he started with when he was looking at the neuroscience underlying people's distinctions. So if we can document that people, in fact, make this distinction, what might be the psychological reasons behind it? And from that, a body of research has grown that seeks to answer the question of what is the underlying structure of the human moral mind? What is the moral mind? And Josh Green uses this metaphor of sacrificial dilemmas being our version of a fruit fly, right? So geneticists were able to get a very, very easy organism that has, you know, DNA and reproduction, lots of generations and very short span of time, and we can just study the fruit fly to death and we can learn a whole bunch about genetics. So he says, so we can use trolley scenarios to learn about the moral mind. All we need is to throw up some dilemmas on Amazon's Mechanical Turk and analyze the results. Now, there's a problem, and I want to just say a few of the problems from an empirical approach in using these. Because the assumption that you can understand the underlying structure of the moral mind is really one, if you take a look at what these sacrificial dilemmas are doing, they're asking, are you, for instance, you here, are you a consequentialist, a utilitarian about morality? Or are you a deontologist, a non-utilitarian, right? So do you believe that what is right is defined solely by whether good is maximized, as a consequentialist might say? Or do you believe that there are constraints upon action, principled constraints that you should be sensitive to despite the consequences? That should already be a warning flag. The thought that people are principled in either way, in any consistent fashion, is something that social psychologists should be sort of almost a priori suspicious about. And in fact, it turns out that there are quite a bit of contextual effects. That is, depending on how you ask the question, you will get a different answer. So it leads to this problem that, well, if depending on particular ways in which I ask the question is yielding different results, am I learning anything about the deeper structure of the moral mind? I think the answer is no, and I'll share with you a few of our findings on contextual effects. Now, I think these are interesting findings because they're not just trivial contextual effects. That is, we know for various reasons that any, you know, the color of the walls might influence whether you respond in a certain way or not. And so there might be completely irrelevant considerations that you need to take into account when you're giving a study and you try to control for these. And some of these are just trivial, right? The people in fact might be grumpier in the morning if they haven't slept well. It doesn't mean that sleep is intrinsically important to the moral mind. It just means that people are grumpy. The contextual effects that I'm going to talk about, I think, are pose a deeper worry. And that deeper worry is that people aren't anything. People aren't consequentialists. They're not utilitarians. They're not virtue theorists. They're not anything, because in order to be that, you have to have a fairly sophisticated, principled understanding of what the normative answer is that you're giving. And just because we can force somebody to answer yes, it's right, no, it's not right, doesn't mean that they are actually responding in that way because they have these beliefs. So I will just give you a couple of examples. This is from the work I did with Peter Ditto, David Tannenbaum, and Eric Ullman on motivated reasoning. And this takes me back to one of the reasons that I became interested in the question of moral psychology to begin with. And it came from early on asking my parents, when I realized as a young child growing up in America, what Hiroshima and Nagasaki really were, just dropping an atomic bomb on millions of innocent people. And I said, wait, isn't killing civilians one of those things that are wrong? And I remember their answer, no offense to my dear mother, who is otherwise very consistent and moral. Her answer was, well, it probably saved lots of future lives. It's a very consequentialist response. But of course, in any other domain, if I were to use that as a justification, she would have been abhorred. So this led me to, so why was she endorsing this consequentialist view? And importantly, she was endorsing the principle. She seemed to be endorsing the principle. That is, it is justified because it is a good thing to save many more future lives, if you know. But she also would appear to be endorsing the very opposite principle. And that just, as long as we're using a reasonable definition of principle, that's not what it is to use a principle. It is, principles are supposed to be sort of broad things that we apply to like cases. So what we wanted to do in these studies is see if we could actually show that people were claiming to be principled in some particular way, but in fact flipping around. That is, they were endorsing the principle that was most convenient for them at the moment. And so this is the first study. Where we started was that, you know, philosophers often, when they're describing these scenarios, they use things like person A and person B or Smith and Jones. We said, well, let's give them real names. Let's give the fat guy a real name. This is a real person. Let's either call him Chip Ellsworth III, which is stereotypically associated with a very upper crust, probably white, rich individual, and Tyrone Payton, which is a name associated with, in the United States, African-American individual, probably lower class. That's all we did. Now, it's not that we were trying to document racism, because there's one or two findings that already show that people are racist. What we wanted to see was whether people might actually differentially endorse the consequentialist or the non-consequentialist, the deontological response, when we made the name either Tyrone Payton or Chip Ellsworth. I'll show you the data. At first we said, are you allowed to throw the back guy to stop the train to save 100 people, because we wanted more people to say yes, but we didn't even have to do that. This is actually using a different sacrificial scenario called the lifeboat dilemma, where you either everybody on the lifeboat will die, or you throw one person off, and therefore everybody lives. So again, it's a sacrificial moral dilemma. what I'm showing you here is the difference between people who are politically conservative and people who are politically liberal. It turns out that if you ask a liberal person whether it's okay to throw Tyrone Payton off of the boat in order to save the lives of all of the other people, they very much say this is not right. Moreover, when you ask them about the general principle, if you just try to formulate what consequentialism means in a way that a layperson can understand, you say, is it morally right to save, sacrifice people for the sake of saving greater lives? Just ask them whether they endorse that principle, they will reject it. So what you're showing here is this flip, that liberals think it's not right to throw Tyrone Payton, and moreover, consequentialism is wrong. Conservatives, on the other hand, show a difference when you ask them about Tyrone Payton. If you use Chip Ellsworth III, a presumably white rich guy, you get the reverse effect. Now, these plots are sort of funky because political orientation is on a scale, and so these are plotting standard deviations. If you really look at the data, what you see is conservatives are not distinguishing between the white guy and the black guy. It's the liberals who are really saying, don't throw the African American off the boat. The white people, sure. Right? So if you want to see who is biased in this case, what you're showing is liberal bias. We don't need to show that. We can actually show it. I'll show you, you know, just depending on what you ask. There are other cases in which we documented motivated reasoning. I won't go into this one too much, but you can very easily show, and this time it's not conservative liberal, it's just the principle of harm reduction. Right? So now moving beyond consequentialism versus deontology, very often what you'll hear people endorse is a general principle, especially liberals in the United States and many other probably Western nations, for programs like needle exchanges or the distribution of condoms, the argument goes, well, look, it's not that I want people doing drugs, right? Or it's not that I want young kids to have sex before they're mature. It's that they're going to do it anyway. And so we might as well prevent the spread of harm. So as a principle, this sounds fair. And in fact, you'll hear, you know, in as I do often in liberal institutions, you almost hear mocking of conservatives for being so insensitive to the consequences and not endorsing the principle of harm reduction. But you don't have to go far to get liberals to be just as opposed to the principle of harm reduction. That is, they say that they endorse this as a general principle, but you can very easily show that they don't mean principle in the way that they ought to mean principle, that you just change the scenario around and people will, they will actually say, no, it's a horrible thing to do. I don't care what the consequences are. So in this example, we just contrasted the distribution of condoms to middle and high school kids in California's public schools to prevent the spread of disease and pregnancy. And the policymakers say, although it may be wrong for children to have sex at such an early age, at least we can do is minimize the harm that results from the decision to have sex. Another condition we said that there is this problem that the US armed forces, when they're in other countries, the male soldiers engage in sexual violence toward the local women. So policymakers said, well, look, we don't want the soldiers to engage in this behavior. We don't want them to rape women. But they're likely going to do it anyway. So the least we could do is ask them to wear condoms so that they can at least prevent the spread of disease and pregnancy. Of course, you don't even need to do a conservative liberal split here. We just ask people, do you agree with the decision of the policymakers? How moral or immoral is it to distribute condoms? Do you think that the policymakers are intentionally promoting either sex or sexual violence? And then agree or disagree with the following principle. We should act to minimize the harm, even if minimization of this harm is seen by some as promoting immoral behaviors. And what you get is, this on the 7-point scale, is that distribution of condoms to kids is more likely to be endorsed, right? They agree with the policymakers. They think it's moral to distribute condoms. They don't think that it's intentionally promoting sex, and they endorse the principle of harm reduction. Of course, you get below the midpoint when you're talking about sexual violence. We didn't look at this until later, but it turns out that this is driven largely by women who are especially opposed, as you might imagine, to the thought of sexual violence. It's depressing, actually, the flat line that you see when it's just men. But again, you get these contextual effects, and depending on what examples you use, you'll get different answers. I won't go into this one, but we can situationally prime people with either patriotism, this is Americans, or multiculturalism, and then you ask them a very similar question about a military action that has the side effect of killing civilians. So it's foreseeable, but it's not intentional. And depending on whether you prime them with patriotism or with multiculturalism, you get a full reversal of whether they endorse the action and the principle behind that action. This is a different set of examples. So it's not just that people are contextually influenced, but they actually are making meaningful inferences about behavior that go beyond what these scenarios are trying to measure. So this is another set of studies that we did showing that, look, if I ask you, for instance, is it okay to sacrifice an innocent life, like push the fat man in order to save more people, here's one thing that matters. If you immediately say yes and you push them and you laugh, you're probably a bad person, right? That's not the kind of consequentialist that we want. What we want is somebody who, if they're going to make that moral decision, they do it with some weeping and gnashing of teeth, right? They, through hard decisions, they say, oh yeah, I agree, this is the right thing to do, right? So the Peter Singers of the world, we accept that they are endorsing some things that are not intuitive because they've actually thought quite a bit about them. But what we don't like is somebody who willy-nilly decides to kill innocent people, even though it is very consistent, the action itself is very consistent with sort of what a consequentialist might say is the right answer. So this is another famous case, smothering a baby, Nazi Germany. Nazis are coming, a bunch of people are hiding from them, there is a baby who's making noise. They know that if the baby continues to make noise, they'll be found and everybody will be killed. The way to stop this is to actually smother the baby, knowing that you'll kill it, but thereby saving everybody in the group. What this is, and I apologize for the weird scale, this is an index of a bunch of questions asking people, essentially, whether it is the appropriate thing to do to kill the baby, to smother the baby. What we manipulated was whether or not the person making the decision, who wasn't the parent, but it was somebody tasked with making the decision, whether or not they made the decision with time to deliberate about the right answer, or whether the Nazis were just right next door and they had to make the decision quickly. So red bars are making the decision immediately, blue bars are with time to deliberate. The decision, if you look at the blue bars, if you say smother the baby, you took your time to make that decision, that's acceptable, right? You know, you do the math, it turns out that it really does matter. But also if you say, no, I can't handle smothering the baby, these higher numbers indicate more positive evaluation. If your immediate gut reaction is to not kill the baby, you say, no, this is just wrong. We also like you, that's good. You should have these human emotions of not wanting to kill babies, I think. Not wanting to kill babies is a good thing. If you immediately say, smother the baby, and you do it, you're not a good person. And we don't think that you did the right thing. So the very same action that we might say a consequentialist, we might say shows consequentialist reasoning, in this case, it seems as if what we're inferring about the person is not really that they are Peter Singers. We're inferring that they're psychopaths. I have a story about this. I had to give a lecture on moral psychology. Cornell has a prison education system. It's a wonderful thing to do. Maximum security prison in upstate New York. On good behavior, prisoners are allowed to take classes, and part of the program is that we have guest lectures. So they asked me to give a guest lecture on moral psychology, which I felt I was very nervous about. You know, these are people who know more probably about morality than I do at this point. But these are murderers, rapists. I mean, these are maximum people who are in prison, sometimes for life. I found out that I wasn't allowed to carry any computer equipment, so I had to just get up there and kind of just talk. And I had asked the director, I said, you know, I was going to talk about psychopaths, but I don't know if I should. And he said, no, believe me, treat them just as if you would treat, just as you would treat anybody else. I gave them the throw the fat man scenario. I gave them the two, just like I did you. I said, pull the lever. And in the audience, there must have been 50 prisoners. In the audience, you pull the intuition. Like, you say, well, what's the difference? And I go, oh, yeah. So most of them were like, yeah, you know, I don't know why. That one's wrong. And there's a guy in near the front. And forgive my French here. He yells out, it's the fucking same thing. That was his immediate reaction. So pushing the guy to his death, pulling the lever. And then you hear sort of nervous laughing because, by the way, these prisoners are on in this program for good behavior and they can get kicked out like this for bad behavior. So there's some nervous chuckling and the prisoners try to explain to him. They say, no, but you see, in one case, you're just pulling the lever, in the other one, you're pushing. It's the fucking same thing. He can't catch the intuition, right? That there is even if you agree that the difference is trivial, his immediate response was that he couldn't tell the difference between the, and he was just claiming, but you're killing, right? He didn't understand it. That's this person, we don't like them. We want you to be Peter Singer, we don't want you to be that prisoner. Okay, I'll quickly tell about this study that we did. And because I think Guy's actually going to talk more about this line of research. In line with these inferences that we're making about people who might take the consequentialist option, this is with Dan Bartels, colleague at the University of Chicago. We were interested in whether maybe what is driving some people's responses to actually endorse the utilitarian option, the consequentialist option in these scenarios, might not be any real endorsement of the principle of utilitarianism or consequentialism, but rather simply that they don't have the same emotional reactions that we have. And so in line with this, we actually gave individuals a set of dilemmas, actually ones that Guy developed to sort of at least that philosophers would endorse as really distinguishing between the consequentialist and the deontological option, because not all of these do. We gave these to a set of participants, along with a set of individual difference scales. Three scales that have been called referred to as the dark triad. So this is a subclinical scale of psychopathy, just a measure of the extent to which you might have psychopathic traits, even if you're not technically considered a psychopath. I'll just get, these are just example items. Agree or disagree. It's fun to see how far you can push people before they get upset. This sort of meaninglessness in life scale, likelihood that I shall be remembered by no one in 100 years makes my current life seem unimportant. And the Machiavellianism scale, the biggest difference between most criminals and other people is that criminals are stupid enough to be caught. Now, again, what we were interested in, and one of the big assumptions that people like Josh Green, who use these as measures of the moral mind, the assumption that they make is that when you respond with the utilitarian option, it's often because you're a real utilitarian, or I have just made you think more deeply about it, made you reason more. That is, smarter, more reflective people, on his view, are going to be more likely to endorse the utilitarian option. But maybe that's the case, but it seems as if there is a substantial amount of people who, when they are endorsing this, it's not through that route. It's not that they're thinking more. It's just that they probably don't have any problem with the thought of pushing someone to their death. So we wanted to see, let's take that subset of people who are utilitarians by these measures. So I'll call them quote-unquote utilitarians. People who actually respond with the utilitarian option. This is just an example. This is the, are you willing, as a doctor could sacrifice one innocent person, harvest their organs, and save five individuals. And again, all things being equal, should he do it? Here's what you get. So this is the people who are low, medium, and high on these scales. It works when you measure them continuously. And here we have their preference for the utilitarian option. What you see is the more meaninglessness in their life that they have, the more likely they are to report the utilitarian option. The greater they are in Machiavellianism, sort of their willingness to manipulate others for their own goals, the more likely they are to endorse utilitarianism. And finally, the strongest effect, the greater they score on this the psychopathy scale, the more likely they are to endorse utilitarianism. Now, we titled this paper The Mismeasure of Morals because our claim was the following. It's not, even though we were largely understood as saying this, it's not that real utilitarians are psychopaths, right? It's not, so we don't really think that Peter Singer secretly wants to murder people. It's rather that these aren't very good at measuring real utilitarianism. And again, I think Guy's gonna talk about this a bit more. We've done follow-up studies, and others have done some studies using a technique called process dissociation. Essentially, the upshot of these findings is, it's not that these respondents are sensitive to the five lives being saved, is that they're insensitive to the notion of pushing someone off to their death, right? So it doesn't actually matter. You know, it's that first part of the sentence that they're responding to. Should you push someone to their death? And then they hear blah, 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 blah. Right? So it's not like, you know, they're not like scaling up like, yes, 5, yes, 10 is even more, so 15 is even more. So, no, they're not sensitive to consequences in the way that consequentialism sort of in its name would have us believe. So it's not a very good measure of consequentialism, or deontology for that matter. And I'll end with this. The assumption that people are consequentialists or deontologists to begin with, I've already said, is a questionable one because people just aren't, you know, people, even when they say you shouldn't push an innocent man to their death in order to save 5 people, they are not grounding, likely not grounding this belief in you know, Kantian metaphysics. They don't seem to be endorsing the richness of the normative theory that we might think we're measuring here. Rather, what we're assessing is people's simple responses to these stimuli. If you make trivial changes to the wording, if you make, you can actually show that they flip around, not in a way that any philosopher who endorses deontology or utilitarianism would want you to do. In fact, they would probably say, well, you're not a utilitarian if you keep flipping around, right? The whole point is to be consistent. But there is another assumption that creeps in the work of some psychologists, which is the use of these findings, the findings that people are largely have gut reactions in accordance with deontology, deontological ethics, is taken as evidence that deontology itself must be a mindless theory. The assumption that when I induce people to deliberate more and calculate more, I can get them to select the utilitarian option is then taken as evidence that the utilitarian theory must be the right one because when people are smarter, they're both good at math and more utilitarian. Higher working memory capacity, primes that make you think more about calculation, all of these things are associated with responding in the utilitarian fashion. This is taken as evidence that utilitarianism is perhaps the right theory to endorse to begin with. But there's a deep problem there that you are creating a set of stimuli that force people to have one of two responses. The one that you've called the deontological one and the one that you've called the consequentialist one. And there's something weird about making an item that requires calculation, by definition, and then showing that people who like to calculate or who are motivated to calculate choose that option. It's a very circular kind of defense of utilitarianism as a normative ethic. If you wanted to do it right, that is, if you still, after all of this, have the belief that people maybe really are deontologists and you want to figure out whether or not smart people are also deontologists, you could easily create scenarios in which the deontological option requires some form of deliberation, and you could probably show that smart people or people who deliberate a lot would respond to the deontological with the deontological response. So the grander task of some of these psychologists to use psychological evidence as a way to defend a normative theory is as problematic as we've thought all along. That is, this is naturalistic fallacy. We cannot just willy-nilly take psychological data and feed it into our normative theories. So I will end with that. I've already said this, and leave it to Guy to wrap it up. And maybe we can find something to disagree about. Hopefully.
Hi.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.